Oh, and here we go. It's We Talk Comics number 55. That's right. We have done 55 of these suckers, and we're just getting started. This is Mo, the Crown Prince of Charisma. Why not? I'll throw it back out there this year. Because if I say it on this show, eventually it'll take off. So I'm joined, of course, by...
for a while now. Hasn't taken off.
There hasn't been one other person. It's amazing. Chris, that was you. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Yeah. Been a little down this week, but the RZA has a movie in the theaters tomorrow, so things are looking up.
All right, and I'm glad you're glad. Brett, how are you?
Well, I think I can honestly say that that's the first and probably last time that I'll ever hear somebody say the RZA has a movie in theaters tomorrow when things are looking up. So,
most likely.
I'm doing okay, but for completely different reasons.
Hey, Keith.
I'm well, Mo. Thank you for asking.
And how do you feel about the RZA?
I don't know what that means.
Chris, don't tell him. Just don't bother.
I wasn't going to.
All right, this is We Talk Comics number 55 of the day. This one at WTC. This show will be called Reviewing the Reviewers. And, of course, as always, we'll get into that a little bit more down the road. That'll be this week's topic. But, of course, as you guys know, we have this thing we call the weekly news with... somebody help me out here.
Club Reporter K.
Club Reporter K.
This is a totally different news segment this time around.
The weekly news with Club Reporter K, sponsored by Comicosity. No, sponsored by Comicosity, the very best comic book website on the internet. Comicosity, your top source for news, reviews, interviews, previews, and more. Don't be a geek. Visit Comicosity and proudly be a comic book geek. Now, the weekly news with our friend Keith. Thank you very much. The weekly news with Club Reporter K.
All right, well, because this is the most unique newscast in comic podcasts, I'm going to start with the corrections. Last week we didn't have Brett with us, and as always, we miss Brett when he's not with us, partly for his sparkling personality, and partly because he edits out the mistakes we make. For example...
More number two.
For example, Scott Snyder and Jim Lee are not working on a Batman-Superman book. They're working on a Superman book that will at times guest appear at Batman, but not regularly. It's just a Superman book. Yes, I got your letters. Yes, I got your tweets. I blame all of the headlines that refer to Batman/Superman writer Scott Snyder. proper punctuation there would have made that much clearer to me. Anyway, the second correction...
another one? Good job.
The other one is Mo. Centauri. Centauri.
Centauri. I know that. I was going to get there.
But I wanted it off the top. All right. Well,
once again, I am not to be corrected. Perfection in all its forms.
Once again. Not since last week.
Yes.
We correct you, actually, in podcast. Just...
And now we have Brett back, so next week will be his chance to be correct.
Beverly Hills 910202.
Well, that happened before the show, so it doesn't count anymore.
Really?
It's not comic book news, but let's all be honest. There is only one giant story this week.
It broke Twitter.
Star Disney Wars.
Well, it is comic book news related.
When You Wish Upon a Death Star, that was one of my favorites. Darth Mouse. So, Walt Disney has bought Lucasfilm.
What?
And has announced Star Wars 7 through 9. We know nothing about the Star Wars 7 to 9, other than they will be. There is a plot outline by George Lucas. He did meet with Mark Hamill over the summer. And Carrie Fisher to tell them that he was going to be planning it.
Good casting on Jabba with Carrie Fisher.
Oh my God!
Well,
Brett, it's too good to take out, but still. Anyways, let's go around the room and get the thoughts. Starting with you, a jackass, Chris.
My first thought actually was, how can we work this into our news? My second thought it was, can Dark Horse survive?
Yeah, they lose their Star.
They lose their Star Wars license. They lose their Indiana Jones license, which, I mean, let's face it, isn't a big comic book deal. How is this going to affect their bottom line?
More barbed wire.
That's such a financial moneymaker for them.
Well, I think that they, as long as they have the Mignola-verse, so to speak, then they'll probably be okay, but they're definitely going to lose the Star Wars line.
Yeah, I'm not sure. The Mignola-verse, that was what I thought, too, is that it could mean real trouble for Dark Horse. And I'm looking forward to the Spider-Man Han Solo crossover.
Yeah, why haven't we had, there haven't been crossovers into the Star Wars universe before. To any kind of great extent, have there? Is there any?
Spider-Man, Mickey Mouse, Han Solo, that'll rule.
I'm looking forward to relaunching the Star Wars comics as a Marvel imprint. It could be called Star Wars Now! All right, Brett is holding up one of the Star Tours action figures, which, as you know, is great, great podcast.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is awesome audio podcast material right there. Which one do you have more than one, or just have one of those figures, Brett?
I have
the mashup figures.
Yeah, I have Donald Duck as Han Solo and Goofy as Darth Vader. And, you know, I'm thinking, see, the partnership was natural. It was just bound to happen.
I have Goofy as Chewbacca, and I have Donald Duck as Darth Maul.
In some ways, it was natural. I mean, let's face it. I mean, there has been some partnership in the past, hasn't there, between these two entities, regardless.
Yeah, Star Tours. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And
Captain EO.
Captain EO. Yeah, way back then.
And the Indiana Jones ride in Disneyland as well.
So there you go.
Pixar and the animation department over at Lucasfilm has been accused of collusion, and there was a court case about it not too long ago.
Mm-hmm. So, whose turn is it now to sound off?
I think it sounds like yours, Keith.
All right. Well, I think it's really exciting. This is actually the first time that I went on to a major news site, saw a news story, and thought, I'm going to go to Twitter to find out if this is real or not. It's the exact opposite of my experience with news over the past year. I needed someone to... it just sounded so completely ludicrous, but amazing that it's also been announced that Lucas intends to donate most of the $4 billion price tag to education.
Oh, that's good. That's good news. I hadn't heard that.
Through his existing foundation or a new foundation. But yeah, the bulk of the proceeds will go to charity. It will create a charity, essentially. I personally am excited about Star Wars 7. I think it's everyone complains constantly about the prequels. You turned up three times the opening weekend, so, you know, suck it up.
Here's the thing. Not everyone does complain about it. Our generation complains about it, and then there's a generation below us where there's many, many huge fans who look at those the way that we look at the episodes 4, 5, and 6. So you got to keep that in mind.
That's true, and I have always remembered, Mo, you telling me about taking your niece to see Phantom Menace, and how much was it, one or both? Was it both your nieces?
It was two of them, yeah.
Yeah, and just how much fun they had, and the, you know, the wonder in their eyes watching that movie, and that's always stuck with me. Through all of the cynicism and the complaining that I've seen over the years, that's always stuck with me, your story about that.
And now those kids are getting older to the point where they're going to have kids pretty soon. They're going to have, those kids are going to have now Star Wars as well. So it's a generational thing. I mean, as much as we complain about it, and I don't even complain about them because I don't think they're that bad, but generally our generation complains about it. There is another generation that really, really does love those films. And the other thing to keep in mind is that for me, I'm just going to jump in here, is we've been hearing for a long time about parts 7, 8, 9. I mean, I have heard rumors as far back as 5, 6 years ago that they were going to try and get the original cast to do voices and then use computer-generated some sort of imagery in order to present them in there. I would be surprised if they don't still go in that direction, because these aren't young people, depending on their view. But also that the idea is that they originally, there was the rumors that Lucas was going to be, by the end of 9, that the point is that it originally was conceived as actually a 12-part storyline. By the end of 9, that's where Lucas officially, as Obi-Wan, tossed on the skies, or the lightsaber, I guess you would say, the mantle of the Jedi onto the next generation, who will then start in 10, 11, 12 by themselves. So, I mean, I don't think we're... Again, you talk about... Another thing we have to keep in mind is we're talking about George Lucas here being... meeting with Hamill and that type of thing. I mean, he also said in the press release, it is time for me to give this to a new next generation of filmmakers. I mean, I imagine that ultimately he might have something in the outline, but, I mean, he didn't direct Empire or Return of the Jedi. I don't think he wanted to direct all three of the episodes 1, 2, and 3. So he might have some outline, but I do think we're going to see, I imagine he's going to go after somebody like a James Cameron or a Peter Jackson or someone like that in Disney, and they're going to do their best to get somebody of that level in to direct 7, 8, 9 and to do these type of things. That's what I see happening here. And that's, to me, what I will be interested in if it goes in that direction. But that's my speculation.
I think my brain would just start leaking out my ear if Peter Jackson was going to create a Star Wars movie from a George Lucas plot.
That would mean that 9 or 7, 8, 9 would become 7, 7.5, 7.8.
But the thing is, I don't believe if he is going to give it to the next generation, Peter Jackson is the next generation. He's going to give it to somebody who's a high-quality filmmaker. He's not going to give it to... I don't think he's going to give it to somebody who's, you know, below average. I think he's going to go after somebody who's already a superstar, but the next generation.
I think a Bryan Singer, a J.J. Abrams, Joss Whedon would be a much, much better bet than Peter Jackson.
Well, it's just an example, but Peter Jackson, James Cameron. I could see all these guys. You see, the thing is, Star Wars, I can guarantee you all those guys whose names have been thrown out there, if you say to them, you want to do a Star Wars, all of them would go, oh, God, yeah. Like, they would salivate at the idea. I mean, hey, who wouldn't?
I'm not positive there's that much age difference between Joss Whedon and Peter Jackson.
No, it might not be.
I don't think it's about age.
I don't think it's enough to be a generation, that's for sure.
I just think of him as a younger filmmaker, actually.
Joss Whedon?
I never thought about it before, but you're right.
Buffy's like, what, almost 20 years old?
Yeah.
He's not a young filmmaker.
He's like 40s.
Yeah, and neither is J.J. Abrams or Bryan Singer, for that matter. They're all about the same
age.
Peter Jackson. They're all about the same age.
Brett's going to say something, and then unfortunately, you just handed me a great segue, but now it's time for Brett to talk.
Just remember the segue. I'll prompt me on the segue, and I'll feed it back to you.
Bryan Singer.
Okay. So, anyways, I'm happy about it. I know that there's lots of people on Twitter who make all the disparaging comments. One of the more interesting comments that I did see was that everybody complained about George Lucas writing and directing the prequels. So now, essentially, they're complaining because he's not writing and directing the next ones. I don't really understand it.
Yeah, it's true. There's just trolls on the internet who love to complain.
Oh yeah, of course there are. Like one of the real interesting things that I saw was the Fox, now kind of lack of partnership with Lucasfilm, because Fox owns the rights to A New Hope, to distribute A New Hope in perpetuity. And they own the rights to distribute the rest of them till 2020. So it's an interesting question of what's going to happen, you know, with the movies even until that point. So I think we'll... And, of course, Fox still owns, you know, the rights to the X-Men and the Fantastic Four. So there's lots of Disney products over at Fox right now.
Yeah, but it means if this is about a lot more than just movies. It's about a lot of merchandising, that type of thing as well, though.
Oh, the merchandising is definitely the big deal. What did I think I read like $12 billion for the merchandising alone?
Yeah, exactly.
And tech. I mean, Lucasfilm has all the best equipment and technology. Disney can really ramp that up through all their lines.
Absolutely.
So that's exciting there.
And you know who likes to use tech? Bryan Singer, I've heard.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Bryan Singer, because that's the next news story that I have.
What a coincidence.
So, Matthew Vaughn has dropped out of directing the sequel to X-Men First Class, which is X-Men Days of Future Past, and it will be directed by Bryan Singer, who's returning to the franchise after having, unfortunately, not directed X-Men 3, where he went on to do a horrible job directing Superman Returns, and...
I will dispute that on you, but we'll have to do a fanboy film review.
Oh, the sequel to a movie no one ever saw. So that's coming up at Days of Future Past. Interesting. What do you guys think? It's the continuity of these films is now a complete mess. because this really
well,
looks
I just
like
throw
they want to
out,
make
I just
it
throw
all
out number three.
Story.
Like, I'm just throwing out number three because it sucked. And it sucked to the point where I haven't even watched Wolverine Origins. So I just throw out number three and we go from there.
Number three will seem like a breath of fresh air and a handful of candy next to Wolverine Origins.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to disagree there. The third one is much worse than Wolverine 3. I wouldn't want to be caught on a desert island with those two movies.
It'd make you stop watching movies pretty damn fast.
I could watch those opening 9 minutes of Wolverine over and over. Well, and we've heard rumor that the Famke Janssen's doing a cameo in the second Wolverine film as Phoenix. So I'm not sure if there's any like if the continuity is going to make any sense in these movies by the end, or if it's supposed to.
It should be.
It's its own special continuity.
Everyone seems to be really surprised by this announcement, but Singer did produce X-Men First Class.
Absolutely,
as soon as Vaughn dropped out, I was like, "Oh, okay, Bryan Singer do it." I actually thought he was on board months ago.
Here's my big question. Did you say Famke Janssen is going to maybe perhaps be Phoenix? In the current Marvel universe, can anybody confirm to me that Phoenix is currently a 47-year-old woman?
Well, she was Phoenix in X-Men 3.
Yeah, 12 years ago when she was a 35-year-old woman.
Yeah. And I don't know
She's 47.
When the Wolverine takes place. I don't know when the Wolverine takes place. We don't actually know. I'm assuming that Days of Future Past takes place after X-Men First Class and before X-Men Number 1, if they're still in the same continuity. In fairness, it probably makes as much sense as regular X-Men, as X-Men comic book continuity.
Yeah, no
And Days of Future Past, as I remember, has time travel in it. We could possibly get a loop going that will X out Brett Ratner.
That would be handy. That would be very handy.
Just have the movie just sort of cut off that timeline. That is now an alternate timeline we don't have to worry about.
But, you know, you talk about current Marvel continuity and what a mess it is. I like that one of the books we're going to be reviewing this week, and we'll get to it a little more, A+X actually just says in the beginning, when you're like giving you a rundown where it goes, and what's the continuity and where this takes place? Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the stories that rock was the quote in the front page to all of us who worry about continuity. Don't worry about it. Just enjoy the fact that these stories rock so much. In other words, they have no clue.
I'm actually fine with it when they just tell you that right up front.
Yeah, actually, I was better with that. I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to put my brain aside. Thanks for letting me know. Probably best for me anyways. All right. Any other news there?
Yeah. I know you're a huge fan of her work, Mo. I know that you, every time I mention her name, you go, who? Kobe Smulders will be back in Captain America 2 playing S.H.I.E.L.D. Agent Maria Hill.
Who?
Hey, see? It's a thing now. Our pal Ryan Ferrier, a friend of the show, has launched a self-publishing comic book imprint called Challenger Comics. Hey now. Ryan Ferrier, creator of Tiger Lawyer.
I'm just
kidding. Which, if you haven't heard, is about a Bengal tiger who happens to be a practicing lawyer.
I heard that.
Which is a pitch I make him tell me every time I interview him. So he's launched Challenger Comics. Their next book will be called Orc Girl from Paul Aller and Thomas Boatwright. And this is also the readchallenger.com is the website. So we'll make sure to get Ryan on very soon to talk about this initiative. And there's a couple of comic books on that website that you can read for free, and you can get copies of Tiger Lawyer there as well. And the Kickstarter for The Goon movie is moving along. 9 days to go. They are just over a halfway point on their Kickstarter. They've got some artwork up. This got my attention today with a sales pitch that I didn't quite buy. It kind of stopped my brain. The sales pitch to support the Kickstarter was, tired of Hollywood recycling crap, support The Goon. And I thought, unoriginal ideas in Hollywood. Tired of unoriginal ideas in Hollywood. And I thought, is that adapting a 13-year-old comic book exactly where you want to go with unoriginal ideas?
Yeah, I understand their point, but I get yours too.
Do new things, like what we started in the late 90s.
Yeah.
But we wish them well with the Kickstarter anyway. $232,000 out of $400,000
wow.
campaign there.
And that's just to start pre-production.
Yeah, it's why we're in podcast. Movies are expensive.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because it's a whole lot easier for us to describe those action figures than it is for us to actually show them.
They do have a pledge level of over $10,000, and they do have one backer at that level. Which
That's
is horrendous. It is a private screening of the finished film story reel in California, and all the creators will be there.
And Eric Powell will enjoy that screening all by himself.
Heyo. And as for actual comic book news, it's actually been quiet. It's been kind of quiet.
That's all right.
We did see the creative teams of the next couple of arcs of one of my favorite digital first comic book, Legends of the Dark Knight. We're getting an arc written by Christos Gage, and then an arc by David Tishman with Chris Spouse and Carl Story art. And a one-off by Paul Tobin coming up as well. So some interesting creators coming up. Really digging that book. And that's the news.
All right, cool. Cool. All right, guys, let's get into this week's topic, reviewing the reviewers. I'm going to go into this just a little bit, kind of give a background on this. Actually, Brett, why don't you open it up kind of however you feel comfortable here, and then I'm going to follow up on that.
That's a loaded start, but...
Yeah, it is.
Well, I've long been talking, and I know that Mo has just recently brought it up about, you know, people who review comics on the internet, and certainly, you know, we all do it here, but I think when we talk about reviewing on the internet, it's how do you accept the veracity of the reviews when there's only positive reviews to be found? The question is, that I ask often is, where do negative reviews belong? Do they belong? And then on a site that you know, are the people who are reviewing the comic books reviewing it because they just want to be truthful? Are they reviewing it because they're just fanboys? Are they reviewing it because they really hope to get a retweet from the creator that they're writing about? There's just so many different questions that I have to ask. And I mean, because I do this myself, I ask that of myself. I want to know, when I review a comic book, the number one question that I ask myself when I review a comic book is, will I read this comic book again? In 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, is this going to be something that I am going to want to read again? And if it is, then I'm going to give it a good review. If it's not, then I'm not going to give it a good review. But the truth of the matter ultimately lies in that I strive to review comic books in a positive, somewhat positive, and honest way. There's got to be, you know, it's like, why don't I like that comic book? Is it the art? Well, why? Why don't I like the art? Is it the writing? Why don't I like the writing? I mean, we laugh on the podcast when we do a negative review that's just like, this book is crap, I hated it. But on the podcast, I mean, that's fine. But when you're writing a review out, I think it's really important to establish why you didn't like it. And another one last little point that I'm going to make is I did see a tweet, I think that originally came from Steve Niles, and we're going to review a book of his that went through Gail Simone about creators getting included in tweets of negative reviews of their books. And my instant reaction was, it's your damn book. Suck it up. If it's a negative review, well, if it's a troll, you throw it out right off the bat. Hell, I would love somebody to, like, be a troll to my review. I think that'd be just so damn funny to get some idiot who's saying, oh, you're a maroon and you don't know what's going on, versus somebody who actually has thoughtful reasoning behind why they reviewed the book like that, which I think could be something that the creator may actually learn something from. That's my start.
That's your start. Okay. So based on this, of course, we reviewed last week DC Comic Present number 13. And I mentioned that our friend Matt Centauri, who writes for Comicosity, and of course Comicosity are a new sponsor and a great site. They host our show, and they're good guys. I've often said, and I really believe this, that Aaron Long, who runs the site, classiest man in comics. And Matt Centauri, and I'm sorry I called you Centaurum. Like I said, I have politics on my brain right now. At Photo Club, and that's with an F, Photo Club. Photo Cob, not Club. Cob.
No, that's L. Club Reporter K.
Oh, Jesus. At Photo Cub, with the F on Twitter, he gave a review for DC Comics Presents, and he gave it an 8.5 out of 10. And basically, I'm just going to give a little bit here of the background. I'm going to read it out a little bit. He says, it's the new 52 debut, and two perennial fan favorites, Black Lightning and Blue Devil, are in it as the two novice heroes butt heads in Los Angeles streets. A greater threat arises in the very large form of Tobias Whale. The stakes get very personal very quickly, as both Jefferson Pierce and Dan Cassidy have a lot more to lose than their pride. It is a truly excellent to see Andrinko back in DC comic books after his stellar and grossly underappreciated run on Manhunter. Given how well he handled the crafting of Kate Spencer and her supporting cast, I can't imagine a better choice of writer to reintroduce two of DC's mainstay C-less but much-endured characters. Andrinko's Black Lightning is still the ultra-serious, super-responsible Jefferson that we know for years, just significantly younger and back to his early days of teaching high school. His Blue Devil is still a wisecracking, go-lucky guy in a borrowed suit who retains the edge of mysticism around the character many fans came to appreciate in later years. One could even argue that not enough about each of these characters has changed for a universe dedicated to refreshing older concepts with entirely new spins. Basically, he goes on then a little bit more talking about the book. This is just the last couple lines here. His Tobias Whale is great, appropriately grotesque and Los Angeles suitably grimy, even having silhouetted leaf pepper backgrounds as the equivalent of floating ash. If anything, I'd just like to see a slightly more dynamic Black Lightning reflect the Olympic-level athleticism I believe he still maintains in this Brave New Worlds. Nevertheless, this is a brilliant start to what I hope is a bright future for the Black and Blue in DCU. And he gives the book an 8.5 out of 10. And I can appreciate it. I can see he enjoyed the book. Before this book had come out, he had said to me, asked me if I was excited because it was Andrako. And he said, he mentioned Manhunter. And I mentioned I also read Manhunter. I thought it was a tremendous book. And so I was optimistic that he would give me something I really, really enjoyed. Then I read the book and came back and I posted the comment on Comicosity here. I said, I read on this on the weekend and I must say I disagree with almost all your points. Of course, I'll go into this further while reviewing the book on We Talk Comics, but I dare you to read Andrenko's brilliant Manhunter and tell me this is truly anywhere near the same quality. I respect your opinion, Matt, but I think fanmorship may be evident here because of this generic read is more like a 3 out of 10. Now, in saying that, when I say fan worship, he had mentioned how much he was looking forward to Andrenko and how much he had liked him. And I do know that people tend to be more forgiving of creators they think are good or wish to be good or that type of thing. Though, and that's kind of where I went to. Now, he took it the wrong way, I think. And I'm going to read his response. He says, thanks for the comment, Mo, although I take issue with the criticism of my character over what is frankly my honest opinion. While I was indeed a huge fan of Manhunter, to compare the single first issue to an entire run would not be a fair one. If it helps, my meter for this book was the spectrum of other reintroductions executed by DC Comics in the past 14 months, not Manhunter. And in that regard, I felt it was above average in setting up a very basic status quo and getting me excited for what comes next. Sorry you didn't enjoy it. I know how much Blue Devil means to you. Now, I didn't think I was saying fan worship, but I'm sorry if it came across this way. I wasn't meaning to attack your character. I think fan worship is something I've done on this show. And I think it's probably something that everybody who's ever written a review has done to some degree. I don't think it's unnatural or necessarily a terrible thing, but I do think it influences things. So I read this and I started thinking about where do we go with this. And I looked at a lot of his reviews and he gives very high scores. And of course, it's not just him. I was looking at, for instance, other websites. Now, our friend Comic Canuck is the co-owner of Comic Book Therapy. And I go on his website and I see four out of five. And MacGyver gets 4.5 out of 5. MacGyver was a fun read, but Frank Miller's Daredevil gets a 4.5 out of 5, if you know what I mean, in my view. So I just started thinking about what is the role. And I brought this up to Comic Canuck, at Comic Canuck on Twitter. I brought this up about how I think that you cannot judge the quality of a book if you don't put everything into perspective and simply list something that's very enjoyable and you really, really enjoy at the same level of an all-time great book, and that you're not doing a service to the fans. And he actually agreed. And he said it's time to put the hammer down. So he actually took this constructive criticism and looked at it as a way that they could improve their books. But it's not just him, and it's not just these two sites, it's not just Comic Book Therapy and Comicosity that generally have high reviews. It's almost every website out there that reviews comic books. Almost every one, except for maybe some of the very, very big ones. It's almost every one. In fact, I'll recall, and I'm going to throw to Keith next here, because I'll recall Keith talking about one of the reasons he stopped listening to most comic book podcasts is because all they do is review the books, and it's all it is an hour and a half of the four people saying, I like this book. Yeah, I like this book. Yeah, I like this book. Next book. I like this book. I like this book. I like this book. Next book. And then it got old. Am I correct, Keith?
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of things that are playing a factor here. One of them is, I know that Matt, for example, is reviewing books that he went out of pocket for. Mm-hmm. We get review copies for IDW and Dark Horse and Image and Boom, but we don't get review copies for like free review copies of DC or Marvel. So any DC or Marvel book that I review, I've gone out of pocket on. There is, cognitive dissonance kicks in. I am not the kind of person who wastes money on crap. So automatically any book that I have paid for is probably going to be, one out of ten higher than.
Whereas you get a bitter person like me who pays money for something and it sucks and they're like, damn it, I paid $3 for that.
it's not one.
But and then you're angry and it's one out of ten less.
Yeah, but it's true. It does probably flip it the other way. You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? I think that probably was part of it with DC. Though I have to say, I should have probably said this when I was writing it down, comparing Manhunter to Blue Devil. First issue I ever picked up of Manhunter was issue number 8, because it was a part of Crossover, and that very first issue was much higher quality than this. So I think you can pick up any single issue in the run and have it be a higher quality. I wasn't trying to compare an entire run to one issue. Mm-hmm. That is unfair, but go on.
Yeah, and I think that I think it's difficult to, and any rating system is flawed because, when I rate movies on my IMDb app, for example, like anytime I watch a movie, I've looked it up on IMDb, I've looked through the trivia and everything. I love that website, but then I rate it because I like seeing the recommended movies after I've plugged in a bunch of ratings. But after a while, I'm like, if Godfather and Godfather 2 and Star Wars are a 10, like, where is Immortals then? Like, Immortals, for what it is probably a 7, call it. But if it has to be it has to be compared to every film, as opposed to every film kind of like it, then, it's like a 2. So I think part of ratings is that you're rating it against other things of the type, as opposed to every comic that's ever happened. If you read a Daredevil story, I don't think it's fair to compare it to every Daredevil story ever written, because anything by Frank Miller is going to be a 4 to 5, and that anything by anyone else is going to have to be a 3 at most, probably. I don't know what the fair comparison is. Did they succeed in what they were setting out to do? As opposed to, is it the greatest thing that's ever been put on paper? I've given very high reviews to Peter Panzerfaust, for example, because it connected with me emotionally. They conveyed where they wanted to go. Is Peter Panzerfaust as good as the best issue of Frank Miller's Daredevil? I don't know, but I gave it a 9 out of 10 for one of the issues. I don't know what frame you use for the ratings.
I have to sort of agree with you there, Keith. At no time was I, when assigning a review, thinking that I had to compare this to every other comic book I have read, because quite frankly, everything every week would be 2 out of 10 and the review would become completely useless. Now, me, unlike you, sort of enjoys throwing money away on crap. I've always likened collecting comic books to flushing $100 bills down the toilet. If you can do that, you have a hobby. But my criteria for reviewing has always been, would I give this to one of you guys? That said, I enjoy probably Mo's reviews the most, because he is the opposite of me. I think my reviews tend to be fairly positive. He swings the other way, and I use that as a balance to judge where I'm going with my collection. Even when I'm reading reviews, I take nobody seriously on the first couple of reviews. It's a relationship I form with the reviewer, which is one of my small problems with Comicosity. And I mean, this is a very minor flaw. It irks me no end that I have to click through to find out who writes any given article or any given review before. Because, as with all sites that do comic book reviews, there are certain people that I've gone, his reviews are not useful to me anymore. I don't want to click through to that. I kind of wish that on Comicosity, I could see who wrote those stories before I, or reviews before I clicked through, because this is such a personal relationship to me.
Now, Chris, I don't want to, we're not here, I mean, Comicosity, and I believe this, and I mean this, so proud to be associated with them. I think it's the best comic book website on the internet.
But, as I said, it was a very small criticism.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that. I'm but that criticism, you said it's about them and other places. And anytime you can't see that. And because you've decided that this person's reviews are of no use to you. So what is it, if you're to boil it down, that is the factors that make you say, this person's reviews are of no use to me?
Okay. Number one criteria, if they are too negative. Mm-hmm. Any Cool News has their own comic rating area, Any Cool News Pop-Tarts. And I find the reviews so incredibly negative, I wonder why anyone reads comic books on that particular section. It's just
they write
crapping
like
on book after book. Drives me up the wall.
They write, I know that site you're talking about, at that page that you're talking about, and they write like they've been put in, locked in a room and forced to read these books. There's no joy to it at all.
overly positive reviews. I will read an over positive reviewer much, much longer than an over negative reviewer. But still, if I get 10 reviews and they're all glowing 8 out of 10s, I love this book, blah, 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 I'll drop them as well. Now, I mean, from the beginning, I was very uncomfortable with the whole rating system thing. I really enjoy how we do it on our podcast, is we just state our opinions and argue about it. That gives, I believe that gives people more of a sense of what a book is like, and they can form their opinions upon who they relate to most giving the review. I think giving an arbitrary number, because it is just that, an arbitrary number, is misleading. I mean, that was part of your problem. What does 9 out of 10 mean? Does that mean it's as good as Frank Miller Born Again? Or does that just mean it's the best book of the week? Because, I mean, that scale means absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, yep, it does. That helps a lot. That helps a lot. Brett, it's been a while since you've talked. You've had a chance to absorb what everybody has said a little bit. What are you thinking?
Well, I think...
As you knock stuff over.
That's right. You know, crash, bang, boom. Sorry, I just woke up, but... I think that it's an interesting point that Keith brings up as far as the movies and the like. And I mean, I also love really horrible, horrible movies that would never get any kind of review or rating versus, you know, The Godfather or something like that. But in my own way, I love them. And I think
Cabin Boy.
Yes.
9 out of 10 right there. I think it's a 2 on IMDb.
Yeah. Which is high. but the truth is that I can recognize a pile of crap when I see it. And part of that is that if I were reviewing this to a specific person, and I knew that person, then I would say... You know, like, if I were saying to Chris, you got to watch this movie, you'll love it, it's brilliant, it's horrible, then Chris would understand and he would get it. But if I were saying to somebody else, you know, even to my wife, you don't want to watch this movie, it's horrible, you won't get it. And that's just the absolute truth. And I think that it's hard when you're doing it with comic books, because... That was the Catscott, the mascot of our show right there, knocking stuff down, not me.
Angus, thank you, Angus. Yeah. A little meow in the background.
But
the problem with your theory is I have never seen a movie I didn't like.
Well,
yes. That is very true.
Even Hellraiser in space?
Like, it's in space. How can you not love it? Man, I hope they cross over with Leprechaun.
But I think that when you write just for the masses, then you wind up, then you just wind up having to kind of boil it down to one simple concept. And I think that that really should be the concept of, like, you know, what's good about this book, what's not so good about this book. I mean, me personally, I've never given a 10 in a review. Can I conceive of giving a 10 in a review? No, I can't. I've given a 9.5, I think, once. My typical review is about a 7. And that is even high for me. I think, ultimately, the number one thing is that, and Aaron has said this to me, is that since he doesn't force us to write reviews, he doesn't tell us what to review, it's really up to us. Nobody wants to read crappy comic books. It's just the way it is. We all want to read good comic books. When we happen to read bad comic books, well, sometimes we review them. But I understand why people don't. And nobody wants to review nothing but like all bad comic books. It's just craziness.
And it's a different thing on a show like this where we kind of decide, here's a bunch of books, read what we have a short list, basically is how we do it. We have a short list of books that we have an opportunity to read. People read what they like, and at the end of the day we can decide between the short list, pare it down to 3 or 4 books that we all feel comfortable talking about. And so in that way, you're going to read stuff you don't like, and you're going to read stuff you do like. You know, it's a slightly different thing.
Now I want to get back to something that you mentioned earlier, Mo, about reviews on other podcasts. We have had, in the past year, since we did the New 52 reviews for the number ones, we have had ongoing discussions about how we want to review, what we want to review, and ultimately we did stick with the idea of reviewing only specials and number ones. We've gone through discussions of whether we should follow a mini series, for example, or follow series that we're enjoying. And one of the podcasts, and I'm not going to say which one, because I actually did like the podcast overall, but what they reviewed was they would go to their local comic store, they would pick up their pull list, and then they would review the books they bought that week. But that meant that it was almost entirely positive reviews of books that they're like, I love this book, it's my favorite book. And next month, I love this book, it's still my favorite book. Like, well, last month, I didn't believe you, I didn't accept this enough to pick up a book. Why am I hearing about it again? And it would just be ongoing of, these are the 10 books that are the absolute favorite books for me, and I've read nothing else to try other things. See you next week. And I didn't want our reviews to be like that.
No, I mean, we have gone through, like you say, I mean, I at one point was pushing for us to talk. I mean, there was idea, like you say, of following a miniseries every month. I was pushing for completed miniseries or trade paperbacks on occasion. You know, we had the thing we were doing for a little while where we were saying, burn this book, bag this book, or buy this book. And then we found out another site had something very similar, so we went to, what was it? We were doing like Catwoman, Cat's Meow. And
it was, that didn't last long, did it?
That was stupid. I can't believe we ever did that. And basically,
not one of our brighter moments.
No, not smart. Basically, at the end of the day, we went to the idea that we don't, let's just talk about them, and people will get an idea. And a consensus basically off that, and that seems to work pretty good. And we talked how many reviews. I mean, we never wanted to be just a review show. So I know a lot of those shows out there are like they just review. And the reason we added news and reviews to bookend the show with a main topic, 1 to 2 main topics in between. And the reason we did it was just to keep the show topical, give you a reason to come back every week for the news and for the reviews, but then try and give you something different. And we like to mix it up, have a fun show, have a more serious show, have some guests, have some interviews. We don't want to be stale. We think that's one of the things that we're proudest about this show. And so that's kind of how we got to be the reviews. And I know that I mean, I feel comfortable ripping into a book. I don't care about offending the writer or artist. I just don't care. Like, they don't want me to tweet it out. I don't, but you know what? I'd feel comfortable with it because, like, Brett, you say suck it up. I say, yeah, you put your work out there. If you can't handle it, then keep it in your basement and hand it out to your friends. If you put it out there, you've done that. And the same thing, if somebody says to me, you're an idiot for your opinion, that's fine. You can say that. You know why? I put my opinion out there. And so in doing so, I've accepted that. And I don't think it's necessarily being negative as it's being honest. Because if something's great, like for instance, there's something we're going to talk about this week that I loved, I'm going to gush. And when there's something, and I have nothing I hate this week in our reviews, but if there's something I hate, I'm absolutely going to say it. And I think it's just a matter of trying to be honest for myself. Personally. Keith, what do you think on that?
I think there's an absolute truism in all types of reviewing that if you only listen to the good reviews and ignore the bad reviews, you can't trust either one. If you're going to trust the good review, you have to trust the bad review if they're both well written. A lousy written good review is no more use to you than a lousy written bad review. You know, a review that just goes, Grant Morrison could do no wrong, Happy Number One is the best comic that's ever been printed. What use was that? That doesn't tell you anyway, anything. Now, back to your question, back to the question of, for lack of a better term, fan worship, or maybe fan blinders, maybe to put less of a negative connotation on it. This is something I admitted a couple of last episode or the episode before, that when I reviewed John Byrne's Trio for Comicosity, I was almost certainly giving it a higher review than I might have if it was a comic by anyone else.
Whereas I didn't.
That's right. We had dueling reviews. We had accidentally both reviewed the same book. We hadn't called dibs, and our reviews were very different.
But the thing is that the actual concepts within the reviews were very similar. What we had to say about the reviews were similar, but what we got out of it was different because you had perhaps had the blinders on, whereas I just looked at it as like a total rehash of his Fantastic Four work, so it didn't ring to me like it did to you.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, what do you got on your mind there?
I think we're sort of on the same page here. You have to look at the good and the bad. You said you're not afraid of ripping into a book, regardless of offending the creators and stuff. And actually, this week we decided not to review it this week, but I'm having trouble. I need to rip into a book. However, this podcast has a close relationship with the creator, Joe Mulvey.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not want to alienate this creator, yet at the same time, I can't recommend this book.
Yeah,
and I never have.
Which book is that? I have no idea what you're talking
about. Scam 2.
It's Scam.
You managed to talk us in circles. We have no idea what you could be talking about. You are
Scam number two.
A level.
Now, I didn't have much problem giving a negative review to Comics Tribe, their other books. They create some wonderful, wonderful comic books. The Standard is one of the best books I've read in a long time. Red 10 is a quality book. But Scam, the one guy that, you know, if I wanted to talk to, I could say, Mo, hook me up. And I am forced, once again, to rip into his book.
Well, now you can't say that.
You weren't actually forced. In fact, you were the opposite of forced.
you know what? But here's the thing, Chris.
I'm feeling guilty, and that's why I'm coming clean right here. Because you know what? Next week we're probably going to review this book.
No, we're not.
Or we perhaps. I'm sure it would have been up for discussion if I had brought it up.
We don't review issue number twos. Just like we didn't review the Red 10 number two, despite the fact that we got the preview and I thought it was fantastic and blah, blah, blah. We don't do that.
So, well, the truth is that if you have
but
good
anyway,
reasons...
I sat down today and tried to come up with a
now, you can write about it on our website.
That I can... Yes, I'm... I do not feel that comfortable being that honest with it right now, because there are good things in the book. I just did not enjoy it.
But here's the thing.
Anyway,
and you know what?
It was
even better, though, if you don't like... And you know what? Joe Mulvey, I consider him a friend. I do the Mo and Joe show with him. He's a great dude. He's very funny. I like his book. And you know what? If you don't like it, and Joe doesn't like that, and he hates us for it, I don't think he'd do that. But if he did, well, suck it up. Like it. That's it. That's
oh
that's
no.
It.
I'm just trying to discuss accountability.
Yeah, and that's my view on accountability. Suck it up. And you know what? I think if anything, you should talk to him. I think you should. He should be able to sit there, and I don't think he'd dislike it. If you can come on, you can place to him a strong, and it's not about hating it or ripping into it. It's about constructive criticism, because I'm never negative or hate something just to hate it. I'm negative because it's created an emotional reaction where I dislike it. And if it did that for you and you want to come on there and tell him why, I invite you to come on the next Mo and Joe show. I think that'd be fascinating radio, and I think that I don't think he would dislike that. You know, I'm going to throw it past them, but
I personally would like him to finish his story arc before we do that. I mean, two issues to take a creator
2015
to task on two issues.
No, it's enough to take him to task.
I wasn't going to say it. I'm hoping the pace picks up.
I think we were all thinking that one.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you can do it after two issues. Why not? You might influence issue 3, 4, and 5. Issue 3 is set to print, but I mean, you might influence what comes here next. Why not? And you know, again, it's you talk about. You said I'm your counterpoint because you tend to be positive. I tend to be negative. I've taken a look, and Brett has given far more negative reviews than I have, both in podcast form and in the written form. We're talking about the 52s and those ones. Brett actually gives more negative reviews than I do.
I tend to agree with Brett more, so I notice your reviews more.
And also,
I think we're at Brett we're at odds more often.
Probably we are at odds more often. Brett has also a very biting, dry sense of humor, whereas I have a little more emotion and vitriol. So, though he's shown that at points too. Pardon me?
There is also I call it the theory of opposite taste. I have a family member who has exactly the opposite taste in films to me, and it's wonderful. It is so much more useful than someone who has similar tastes in movies to me, because I know that if he says, "This is the worst thing I've ever seen. I hated it so much. I should rent it that night." I have literally left family activities and gone, "I'm going to stop on the way home and get that," because he did. He was so upset about that movie. And I find that more useful, though, than someone who has similar but not exactly the same taste as me.
But really, isn't that why we did the whole Zero episode? Is to fill people in on our backgrounds as your readers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, the truth is that I am a radically different reader now than I was 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And now, as I continue to evolve, I mean, I don't read a whole lot of stuff on a regular basis. I don't read a whole lot of mainstream stuff. And so the concept of reviewing mainstream is like, well, everybody's reviewing mainstream, so why should I? I'm gonna be one of the people who actually tries to review stuff that's not mainstream. And so at least that, because I'll bet you that there's a lot of books out there that just really don't get reviewed very much, whereas A Plus X, which we certainly are going to do on the podcast, is going to get reviewed a lot. But the smaller books are not going to get reviewed that much, and maybe they deserve some press too. It, whether I like them or not, I mean, that's, it's just, it's going to happen or not happen, and I hope I do. I always want to go in and like a book, but I have to be honest about whether or not I do or do not.
I have never once in my life, for review, for personal reasons, for anything, picked up a book and went, God, I'm looking forward to hating this. Ever. I don't know if anybody has, you know? I do want to say, I don't want to come back to this. Keith talked about this a little bit, and Brett a little less, but also talked about it, but mainly Chris. We're talking about rating scales. Mouse, I think, is a 10 out of 10. Okay. Bone, I consider a 9 out of 10. If I am going to give a book I really, really like a 9 out of 10, it has to be as good to me as Bone. There comes the sliding scale, though, where below that, if I give a book a 7 out of 10 and say, man, I really enjoyed this book, this was terrific, great art, great pacing, fun dialogue, 7 out of 10, recommended. And people know every single time that I give a 7 out of 10, that was a book I enjoyed, and that they can count on that being a book they will enjoy if they have similar tastes, that's enough. But the one or two times a year they see a 9 out of 10, and they know that means that's as good as Bone, that works. If they see an 8 out of 10, and they know it lies somewhere between a book that I normally say, I really enjoyed, like I really enjoyed Punisher last week, 7 out of 10. Really, really good book. My favorite book of the week. 7 out of 10. But this book gets, for instance, this week I'm giving a book, say, an 8 out of 10. They'll say, wow, he really liked that one. This was even more. That's fine. But they don't see the 9. They don't see the 10. They don't see those really, the incredible off-the-scale reviews every single time. You can have that scale. And it is a matter of, there's nothing wrong with saying 7 out of 10 is a really good book. And the fact that many reviewers aren't comfortable saying that a 3.5 out of 5 or a 7 out of 10, what a terrific book. They think that's just saying, eh, it's slightly above average. That's where things get screwed up.
Well, because is it because of the concept that they're, that it, that because now, especially with Twitter and stuff like that, is there a certain level of, you know, almost fear that the reaction like wouldn't be there from somebody? Like, you almost have to go overboard to get the reaction that you're looking for, as opposed to a 7, which is probably not going to garner any reaction.
Oh yeah, nobody's going to retweet, the creator isn't going to retweet it if we only say we give him a 7 out of 10. You know what, you're doing it for the wrong reasons then. If you're looking for that, if that's the reason you do it, you're looking for the wrong reasons to give reviews. For me, like I say, a review, Brett talks about, will I go back and reread this? For me, it is, yes, I think that's a strong thing. I will reread a book that's 7 out of 10. I will own and love a book that's 9 out of 10. And if a book's a 10 out of 10, I will talk about it to everybody should read it, who I ever run across. And if a book's a 5 out of 10, that means it's not bad, but I won't read it again. And if it's a 3 out of 10, it really disappointed me. And that's the scale. And I feel comfortable with that scale. And I am rating on a historical basis. And, you know...
But we've never even agreed...
No, we never did. And we don't agree.
And it's about all... reviews we give are definitely personal. And depends on our relationship with the reader. And quite frankly, I'm going to use movie reviews once again as example, because I don't read enough comic reviews, I don't have enough good comic book reviewers in my life, other than the other people on this podcast, that I trust enough to give me comic book advice, because let's face it, I'm the Jabba the Hutt of comic book readers sometimes. I read a lot of books.
Ota Nuka, AVX.
Jesus Christ,
but
Chris.
To go to movie reviewers, I have actually stopped looking at ratings if they give them. If I'm reading them on the internet, I try to block off with my thumb or adjust my screen so I can't see their rating and actually read what they're saying. I think the rating systems give an unfair shortcut to the lazy reader. Because if my eyes cross that 3 out of 10 or the 2 out of 5, I basically assume I know what they're going to say in the main article. I much prefer... let's give a shout-out to my favorite movie viewer on the internet, Vern. Outlaw Vern. Vern, he wrote a wonderful book, Seagalology, the study of the badass movies of Steven Seagal. But he has a website, he does a blog, and doesn't give a review. Forces me to actually read what he's saying, and he says good things and bad things at home.
Doesn't give a review, you mean doesn't give a rating.
Sorry, doesn't give a rating, just a 3 or 4.
What a great review site that would be.
This is my review, a blank page.
But by the end of it, because I formed a relationship with him.
This blank page is better than that blank page.
I know what, by the end of what he's read, I know whether he liked it, whether I would like it, because we quite often disagree. I want to argue with him about a lot of his reviews, because I think they're unfair. But from what he said, I can judge whether I like it or not, regardless of whether he liked it or not. And I think that little shortcut cheats your audience. It really does, because people are lazy in general. Your audience is lazy. You can't depend on them remembering that you gave a book a 7 out of 10, and 7 out of 10 for you is excellent.
No, Chris, and I understand what you're saying, and
because we
you present a good argument, but I'll tell you this: I think if you believe in your writing and you're a good reviewer and you're concise and well written, like Matt Santori is, people will read the review and enjoy the review, and that last little bit is the thing to stick in their memory. Going, he liked this. I remember how much did he like it? Oh yeah, 8.5, or oh yeah, 7, or you know, but it's. You should still break it down and have confidence in your ability to write. I think you, if Vern was giving a rating scale, I mean, I'm still sure you'd be reading it because he's an excellent writer. Let's go around for final thoughts here. Brett?
Well, I think that for any reviewer, the problem is balance. It's all about honesty and balance to me. Like, I don't understand how you can have good reviews without some bad reviews. There's no such thing to me as all good comic books. And that's why part of it is just being honest. I mean, if I don't like it, I'm going to be honest about it. I'm not going to be a troll about it. I'm not going to go out there and say, you know, this is a terrible book because the writer is stupid. I think he's a stupid pants. I mean, that's not, like he said, you know, it's the same thing in the positive element. It's not a good review.
If we could have all reviews end with, instead of a 3 out of 10 or a 5 out of 10, with writer is a stupid pants, I think we'd have a winner.
Well, actually, that might be true. But you know, for me, if I can be honest and if I can give one person out there a reason to pick up the book, or in certain cases, not pick up a book that's not very good and not going to be worth their money, then I think I've done a good enough job. You know, ultimately, we're not paid for doing this, and we have no ties to any comic company or anything like that. We just do it because we love comic books, and we love talking about them, and we want other people to understand the same reasons. And so I think that sometimes there's good, sometimes there's bad, and just be honest about it.
Chris, your final thoughts.
Actually, I think Brett does a very good job at reviewing most of the time. However, the stupid pants remark, I have to take him a little bit to task here. He has wished several creators to die violently at the end of his reviews, which I'm always a little uncomfortable with. But it's only been a couple times. Just thought that's at least as valid as calling a guy a stupid pants.
And that's
I have to call you out on that.
That's fine, and it's only on the podcast that I will ever wish somebody to die violently.
Yeah. You know,
I keep forgetting that we're talking about print here.
Yeah, and, well, not just print. I think we are talking about podcasts as well, both. But that said, let's never again wish somebody to die violently for his comic book work ever again, unless it's Rob Liefeld. Now, Keith,
okay, I only want Rob Liefeld to do good work.
We all wish for that.
I know.
and every time we buy a Rob Liefeld book, it's like a lotto ticket.
I
always feel like a winner until I compare the numbers of my lotto ticket to what actually got drawn. And that is exactly the experience of opening a Rob Liefeld comic book.
Hey, let's be completely fair. The last Liefeld book that I read was Deadshot Zero, and I loved it. Just throwing out there, really? I'm ending on a positive note. He's out
I'm
of comic
sure
book.
I'm pretty sure you were the only one to read a Deadshot Zero, though. I don't know what anybody else.
Is that part of your
maybe he was a grifter, I couldn't tell.
Oh, my Chris. My God. Keith, your final thoughts.
Yes. Well, because as we said, this isn't about comicosity. This is a general conversation.
Oh, this is, yeah. I mean, it's other sites as well.
So while we're talking here, I opened up Comic Book Resources, which is a site that exists. and I went to their review section, and they review pretty much everything that comes out. What pops up under all reviews is 40 comics per page. So I did a quick count. They rate out of 5 stars, including half star reviews. So 3.5 stars, for example. 15 out of 40 are 4 stars or better. 4 stars or 4.5. There are no 5 star reviews in this pot. But 15 out of 40, which is, what's that, 40%, mm-hmm. are 4 stars or 4.5 stars out of 5.
40% of books this week are as good as Bone.
That's right. Out of 40, 3 are 2 stars or below.
So as good as a Liefeld book.
That's right. So, I mean, that's...
That's stupid.
I'm
not picking on Comicosity or Comic Book Therapy and even Comic Book Resources. You're right. It's all over the internet.
I think it's great inflation. Just like how when I was in university, there was a lot of talk about great inflation, that at a certain point, you're actually grading between 51 and 100. You're not grading out of 100. If anything under 50 is just fail, then that's what we all go through school with. Anything under 50, it doesn't matter what it is under 50, you fail. So that gets ingrained as anything under 5 out of 10 is a failed comic, and that's not necessarily true. Mm-hmm. It's just not something, it can be a fine story that does what it's going to do. You'll never think of it again. You'll never want to read it again, but it's just what it was, and maybe that's 4 out of 10. I think for most reviewers, though, that's 6 out of 10.
At least. Yeah, I mean, once again, yeah, like you say, I mean, Matt Centauri, I appreciate that somebody like him and the people at Comicosity and Comic Book Therapy and Comic Resources and all these other sites, I appreciate. I actually enjoy reading Matt and Aaron when they're reviewing, even though I know they're going to be high, because I can feel how much they love comic books. Like, their passion for comic books and how much they love it. And I think they are giving their honest opinion. They probably love that book. Why? Because they love comic books. And I think when they have a comic book in their hand, they just feel like a better person. I know there's times I do. I just pick up one, and it still gives me that feeling. It's a comic book. Damn it. I love them. And I can appreciate that, and I can feel that, and I can feel wanting to be positive. I can't appreciate that. But at the end of the day, I could read them. It's the other... At the end of the day, I need more than just the same review. I need a real scale. For me, what's the role of a reviewer? Try and save people a little bit of money. Try and inform people. Try and entertain people. And you know, sometimes when I'm reviewing reviews, and it doesn't matter what it is, it's comic books or movies or whatever, and different sites, I don't feel like I'm getting that. And that's what I'd like to do here on the podcast. So, for me. So thanks, guys. This was awesome. Let's really quickly do our reviews because this is going long. Ironically, as we talk about reviewers and how we do them, now we're going to do some reviews.
And why do we do reviews, Mo?
Why? Because where? Here I come to
save the day. Saving you from bad comics.
That's right. So it's the world famous We Talk Comics Reviews, known as We Views. Chris, let's open up, man. You have some fun and give us a book you enjoyed this week or didn't enjoy.
Go ahead. I'm going to throw this one out because I think we're all going to have a different review of this book. A plus X number one.
Okay.
I liked half this book, and surprisingly not the half of the book that I thought I'd enjoy. I personally love Dan Slott. His story lost me at Nazi robot, which you'd think that would be right in, but Nazi Sentinels just sent me off on a bad trail. Really didn't like this story involving Captain America and Cable. And really made no sense to me whatsoever. And considering it's a 10-page story, you'd think I'd be able to make some semblance of sense of this half story. But no, I couldn't. It made no sense. It was wasn't funny, which is what I appreciate about Dan Slott. Then I go over to Jeff Loeb, his Hulk Wolverine story, and I have to say, he had a little bit of advantage. Dale Conan, Dale Keown.
Is that correct, Brett?
Keown.
Once again, drawing my Hulk, he's one of my favorite Hulk artists. This is a wonderful story. We have stuff hearkening back 15 years. Really gorgeous work, good action, and this is what I wish the Hulk regular series would be. For the second half of this book, worth your money. Really, really good. And considering it's the back half, I was down from the first half, and just second page in, I was like, oh, no way, we're not going here. Really great second half of the book. I have no idea who goes next in snake format.
It's Keith. Go ahead, Keith. It's no snake format. I'm just going to throw it to whoever the hell I feel like. Keith?
No, that was snake format.
No, snake format has a format.
Oh, come off it. Okay, move on.
How many times are we going to have this conversation?
Apparently 1 million.
How many episodes is this? I don't know what I thought about this book.
I can tell.
I think both stories started off interesting and then just wandered off in a direction. Like Chris said, it's only 10 freaking pages long. How hard was it to hold this story together? Incredibly hard, it seems. Both kind of wandered off in a direction. I did like the Hulk Wolverine story better than the Captain America Cable. I think Captain America Cable started off well, and then, I used to be a huge fan of Cable, and now he's like a spoiled food ingredient. Everything you add him to, he wrecks. I found some of the stuff that you saw in the Hulk Wolverine story. I don't know whether I kind of would rather see some of that stuff, knowing it was going to go somewhere other than just this wacky thing. I am glad that they dropped that awful stuff they were doing in the AV and the A versus X series that this is sort of coming out of.
This is not coming out of it. They said that right at the beginning.
Yeah,
they said, just enjoy this. This has nothing to do with that A versus
X.
It is
the thematic carryover of the A versus X book, because it's called A plus X as opposed to A a versus X. The fight book that was running parallel to Avengers versus X-Men.
And is Hulk or Wolverine the Avenger in this book?
I thought they were both Avengers. Like, I don't know which one's the X in that book. If it's A plus S, what can't Wolverine just have a solo story? I won't be back, obviously. Marvel now is Marvel then.
But wait a second. Is it going to be Slott and Loeb every issue? Like, how's that working?
I don't believe so, no. I think it's...
But you don't care.
Not particularly, but I'll look it up while Brett's giving his review.
All right, Brett, I guess it's your turn. Keith decided.
Yep. Well, for me, the first story felt like a 24-page story that they slammed into 10, that they compiled down into 10 pages. So it felt like there was so much going on that he wanted to write and just didn't have enough time to write it. Mm-hmm. The second half of the book felt like a 4-page preview that they then extended into 10 pages, so there wasn't enough story to truly fill the entire thing. But the art was really nice. But I in fact like the art on both of them, but that whole thing being said, at the end of this I'm like, well, it's another Marvel team up book. Yippee. And I never really dug Marvel team up books, and I still don't.
Okay.
Bucky versus a Sentinel. What the hell were they thinking?
My better question is, why didn't that work?
It should have. It probably should have.
That sounds like an awesome pitch.
Because they wrapped up the... anyways.
But Ron Garney's art is fine.
Here we go. 5 words or less, Chris. I want you in 5 words or less. Tell me what you think of Dan Slott in 5 words or less, what you think of Jeff Loeb.
Dan Slott. Funny. Good at crossovers. That's it. Loeb, overrated, boring, and what the hell is he doing over at Marvel? Marvel
more than 5 television. Get it. Keith, same question.
Slott, good when he's crazy, and Jeff Loeb, exactly rated.
And Brett?
Dan Slott has been good, not always. Jeff Loeb has been good, not always.
See, for me, this is... Dan Slott, for me, is... You know what he is? He's Jerry Bruckheimer. You know what? He gives good, light, enjoyable, generally fun stuff that, at the end of the day, I don't care if I ever read another one or go back and see it or read it again. He does popcorn movies to me. There's no depth to him. He's just he's self-aware. He's talented enough. It's not my style. If he's the popcorn movies, then Jeff Loeb lately is the bathroom. This was one story that's just good enough to read and forget about, and one story not good enough to ever read. Next book, Brett.
All right, well, let's talk. I'm going to just go through Lil Gotham, Batman number 1. I really like this book. I like the art a lot. I love the kids element. I love the fact that this is probably the first comic that I have actually thought that Damian was a truly awesome character in. Because I love it when he immediately goes after trick-or-treaters dressed up as the Batman Rogues Gallery. Love that moment. I thought that this, for a silly Batman story, actually had more good Batman characterization than half of the Batman books written in the last decade but it still maintained a silly outlook. So for me, this was a heck of a good read.
I'm going to give my review. Was it last week or the week before we did Avengers Babies versus X-Men Babies?
Last week.
Okay, so take everything I said about Avengers Babies versus X-Men Babies, replace the words Avengers Babies versus X-Men Babies with the words Little Gotham Batman, and that's my review.
Keith? Except this was only 99 cents.
Oh, okay. Keith?
I love this.
That's the exact same thing you said about Avengers. Oh, I know.
I will even say it's adorable. I thought it was fun. I really like the art. I really like the art style. I think I read this just twice through in one sitting. I just flipped back and I could just stare at the art.
What'd you do with the other 23 hours and 55 minutes of your day?
99 cents. Digital first comic. The Legends of the Dark Knight.
Hey, when I'm looking at reviewers, I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying I want more. When I give a negative review or anything, I'm trying to get these reviewers to challenge themselves because I know they can do better.
Well, I can't wait for Little Gotham Thanksgiving. So if I'm Canadian, I have no idea when American Thanksgiving is. Is it soon? Because I want to.
All I know is that there's a football game or two that plays during it. So.
Yeah. I'm a Canadian who doesn't watch sports. I'm still not.
You're totally screwed.
I'm going to go. I also love this book. I have to say this is the worst titled book of the week. I hate the little in front. It makes it seem like it's something totally not. The comparison to A-Babies versus X-Babies, I think, is apt. However, this is immensely more readable. And I'm looking forward to one of these. They got my 99 cents every holiday. Wouldn't want to amp it up anymore, but for the next four holidays, I'm riveted. I really like the book. Strong stuff.
Okay, Chris, give us the next one.
Alrighty. That would be easy if I knew what the next one was.
Lot 13.
Let's go with Lot 13.
Okay.
New Vertigo book by Steve Niles. I gotta say, I was not expecting a lot of this out of this book, although I've liked Steve Niles on occasion. Really, his vampire/zombie gross out book in recent months has, okay, I've been there, I've seen that. This book really surprised me. I found the story genuinely compelling. Weird is all get out. And I'm going to need help on the artist's name.
Glenn
Fabry.
Fabry.
I've always wanted to see him do an interior, and I think this is the first one he's ever had. Just gorgeous. Definitely. This has the potential to become my favorite book rather quickly. If he doesn't drive it off the deep end with issue 2 or 3, I'm in for a long time. This is just great.
It's only a 5-issue miniseries, so.
Okay.
Hopefully he doesn't drive it off the deep end that fast, then.
Oh, Chris. Keith, what's your review?
Fabry has done internals before, but he's one of those artists that is paid, like he's like Adam Hughes, he's paid so well for covers that he rarely... basically can afford to do interiors. Having been the cover artist on Preacher for its whole run and a couple other Vertigo books. I wasn't huge on this. I kind of wanted to like it more than I liked it. It sort of works. I may enjoy it more. Like, I think I will try another issue to see if I get some flow in it. It felt a bit choppy, and I don't really know where it's going.
You're not telling me you didn't find that little monkey boy thing adorable?
I had
North Star beat by a mile. That was the cutest little monster thing I've ever seen.
I don't know. I think I'll be back for another issue. Ooh. Cold Canadian winters here.
Brett, your turn, man.
Well, I mean, Steve Niles is definitely one of the premier, if not the premier, horror writer in comics today. And I don't read that much of his stuff. I've never really developed a huge taste for it. But I gotta say, this book really left me feeling kind of odd in points. It was, I think it did what it was supposed to do for me, and so I was quite engaged by it. I mean, Glenn Fabry's work is certainly awesome. I mean, his interiors are really nicely done, and I think that's a big part of my enjoyment of the book. But I look forward to seeing where the story goes, and I think it's a good horror book.
Yeah, I think the idea that it's choppy, like Keith said, is probably right. I think it was choppy. But, I mean, I appreciate Niles. I've read Niles' books that are horror and just gothic, grotesque, 70s grindhouse horror. Is probably a better way to put it than gothic grindhouse horror. And I've read more cerebral horror from him. So within the horror genre, I find that he manages to mix things up, and I really, really enjoy his work. The choppiness of this, I think, is because it's one of five, and this is a case where I will say that this is a book that should be read in trade paperback or miniseries form, and this is my exact argument for why I wish we would read and review completed miniseries, because I think this is one where we would go, okay, this is one where we won't be able to give it a true review until we get that, but when we'd be done, we'd be able to really, really lay into it and either love it or hate it and really have it fleshed out. So that's how I feel about this book. I liked it, but I'm going to have to read all five issues in one sitting at the same time, like, you know, no stopping midway, to really, I think, appreciate what's going on here.
Well, somebody better remind us in 4 months then that
you have 4 months to solve on that idea.
And Brett, we're going to do Bedlam from Image. Oh, by the way, I have to say this about Law 13, because Chris said Vertigo. It was a mature reader's book. I do not recall, because I looked a couple times, seeing the Vertigo label on that book. Is it possible? And then inside the interiors, when the character would drop an F-bomb, it would be censored, or any sort of swearing would be censored. I think this is a book that is not Vertigo. I believe this is a book published by DC that they probably got the content, had everything, saw the graphic violence, left everything else alone, and said it's just a little too graphic, let's throw the M on it.
DC Entertainment is actually labeling.
Yeah, not a Vertigo book. I imagine
this week was the big Vertigo book. I apologize.
No, I imagine this was never a Vertigo book, that the decision to make this mature readers was simply because the violence was a little too graphic, and so they decided last minute to change that. Because otherwise, there's no reason to censor the profanity. So, in a mature reader's book. It's just a guess. Anyways, Brett, final book, Bedlam.
Bedlam, all right. Well, we got a friend of the show, Riley Ross, on art, and he does his usual job of wacky art style. And he's very good at his style. And I gotta say that I loved the main character in this book. It's almost like what if Johnny the Homicidal Maniac wasn't completely over the top and funny. It's just that kind of weird book, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty well done, and I look forward to seeing the rest of them.
I love this book. This is a book with balls. This is a book with a ton of balls. The acts that the character portrays are horrific and violent and in no way, and feel very, very hard hitting, but not gratuitous. They don't force feed you a lot of easy storyline stuff. They expect you to be illiterate and smart and focused and pay attention. The art, Rossmo has improved dramatically. He continues to improve. He sets the mood. He's always set the mood extremely well. But what he's doing now is his camera works, so to speak, his panels and that type of thing has improved dramatically. And I'm not sure if that's... I'm sorry, Keith. Can you remind me the name of the writer?
Nick Spencer.
Nick Spencer. Nick Spencer. Nick Spencer, I think that might be because Nick Spencer has... perhaps he's following his script. But as far as his storytelling, it's the best it's ever been. The dialogue is simply terrific. Flows so good. The story is so smart. You look at it to Johnny the Homicidal Maniac. Let's face it. This is another take, much like the Red Ten and Oxymoron. This is another take on the Joker character, but basically the plot is this. The idea that this is the Joker. The Joker is crazy and evil and has no morals, and he's forced to have all... He's magically, all the evil gets sucked out of him, but he's still crazy and weird. And how does he then react and live about the regular world? And it's the story about how he gets to this point, and now we'll see how he reacts to the world from here. So damn good and original. Love, I mean... So good. Keith?
I think that it's clearly the Joker took me out of the experience a few times. It is a book that asks a lot of attention from you. There's a lot to this book, and there's a lot of jumping around. There's a lot of changes in time, changes in place, changes in what is real and what isn't. It's not the easy read of the week, that's for sure. And we were talking before the show about Nick Spencer. I'm a big fan of Morning Glories, but I find I can't understand it when I read issue by issue, and I love it as trades. So I think I'm going to trade weight on this book. I think it'll be worth it in the end. I'm actually less interested in reading the second issue than I am reading issues 1 through 6 in a few months.
Alrighty, I'm actually going to take myself out of this one. I found the initial mass killing scene actually so emotional that I wasn't able to give this book a fair read. As Keith was saying, it is not an easy book.
It has balls. It has balls.
It's gorgeously drawn, and I can see how the writing was engaging, but. Really, after that first scene, I never really recovered. I'm not saying I didn't finish the book, because I did. But really, I think I read it too fast. And I'm actually glad that you guys came out with such glowing reviews, because I want to go back and read this, because really, I finished this book going, you know what? I don't know what to think about this book. There's elements I really enjoyed, yet I was still really very appalled by some of the graphic violence in this. And that's saying a lot, considering some of the crap I read. I tend to really like the violence, but it had more realistic violence than my average book. It affected me on an emotional level. I guess it's a great book from that point of view. Did I enjoy it? I'm not 100% sure.
I've seen a lot of books that are way gorier, but not nearly as hard-hitting, because this felt like this. You're like, this has really happened in this world. And this could really happen. And it's like, this is horrific. And horrific people exist, and it leaves you with that. But like I say, that's part of what gives it balls. I mean, but yeah, I totally understand what you're saying, Chris. Something else. All right, guys, get out of here. Brett?
All right, Brett, Brett underscore we talk on Twitter. I'm finally looking at it again. Brett@wetalkpodcast.com. Otherwise, I'm super busy, so there's not a whole lot going on. Moving on.
Chris?
Chris_WeTalk on Twitter, Chris@WeTalkPodcast.com. Give us a call, drop us a line if you have anything to say. If you have any ideas about this show or what we said tonight, I'd certainly be interested in hearing them. And rate us on iTunes. That would help us out a lot. Get more viewers or listeners for us. Keith?
All right, you can email me, Keith, at wetalkpodcasts.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, CubReporterK. I am still on Twitter. I have actually been off it so much that I got asked yesterday if I had changed my ID or something because I had gotten so quiet all of a sudden. I am still there. I am just about to launch the new blog for the We Talk Podcasts website, 900 Things, which is a very personal journey that I'll be taking over the next 12 months, starting November 4th.
All right.
Mo.
First off, I am Mo, M-O at We Talk Podcasts, or Mo, M-O, underscore We Talk on Twitter. You know what? Yeah, we want to hear your opinion. What do you think is a reviewer supposed to do? I don't care if it's somebody we talked about in the show or somebody we've never heard from before. Certainly feel free and tweet us, email us, or write a comment below the show in the section. And that would be awesome. You know, share the show through the social network and buttons and rate us on iTunes, like Chris said. And for more positive reviews, make sure to check out all the shows over at the Comic Podcast Network. And other than that, I guess we're OUT? We're OUT.